working with Parliament, going to the 14th of March. Suspension of standing order, the Honourable Tim Thompson.
Mr. Speaker, I vote to move under Standing Order 7.3, then Standing Order 7.1, in order to proceed with a government statement.
Mr. Speaker, I vote to move the Honourable Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, the events of last night at Westminster are unprecedented. Prime Minister told the House of Commons at 1 o'clock yesterday afternoon that he would, of course, be voting in favour of the motion standing in her name later yesterday evening. But yet, later yesterday evening, he voted against her own motion, as it had been amended, although it was still standing in her name. The Commons voted by motion to rule out a no-deal exit from the European Union, but that the UK and Gibraltar will still leave on the 29th of March, is still the position in law. It has not changed, and the Article 50 notification can still be revoked in a period of 2 years provided for it extended, but that has not happened yet. The motion before the Commons today seeks an extension to the 30th of June, so long as there is a withdrawal agreement in place before the end of next week, for a longer extension otherwise. But that motion is amendable. In fact, honourable members will have seen that the number of amendments have been tabled. So the final motion of the Commons will not be clear until late this evening. So I told our motion late yesterday, this is a time of unprecedented flight. We have not seen the like of such political uncertainty in the post-war modern democracy of the United Kingdom. The British government is being repeatedly defeated in its own House of Commons. The wooden system of parliamentary discipline has entirely broken down. As a result, I first speak for all of us when I say that I'm pleased that I believe that we are closer to a no-deal exit from the EU being entirely off the table. But let's be clear. We are not supposed to be there yet. But now, the default position in law is still that we leave on the 29th of March, deal or no deal. Until the withdrawal is amended, if the legislation to do so passes the Commons, the default in UK law is unchanged. Even if the Act is amended, the UK will leave the EU on the 29th of March, if the EU doesn't agree to an extension of the Article 50 process. Because at the other end of the spectrum, the United Kingdom may seek an extension of the Article 50 process, but that depends on the EU agreeing that extension. Or the UK may revoke the Article 50 notification unilaterally in the absence of such an extension. The government must therefore in Gibraltar continue to plan for all options, including a now less likely no-deal exit. At the moment, all permutations remain possible. Too many still remain probable. We must therefore plan for all the eventualities that could emerge. The revocation of the Article 50 notification is nonetheless also now a likely possibility. It has now been increasingly mentioned, indeed, the Prime Minister mentioned it just a number of occasions, and honourable members will know that the father of the House of Westminster, Ken Clark, moved an amendment with Vince Cable and one other member from the Labour Party also, which was not directed by the Speaker, and which was not voted on, seeking that the House vote for the revocation of the Article 15 legislation. I believe that the revocation of the Article 15 notification, leading to the United Kingdom and Gibraltar remaining within the European Union indefinitely, would undoubtedly be the best outcome for Gibraltar. A vote may manifest itself also. It may happen as a new referendum. Honourable members know I try never to call it a second referendum, as this would be a new referendum on a new question which I think would be a very legitimate way to go about it in the Tibetan Center. Indeed, as I said, since July 2016, the most legitimate new rate would be to put whatever mechanism for withdrawal or new deal has been agreed, not a vote, with remaining in the European Union as the alternative. That option is now, in my view, undoubtedly the right one, as the Commons has said no to a no-deal exit. It would be possible that the vote could manifest itself at a general election in the United Kingdom. We cannot let our guard down, and we will not let our guard down, and we will not let Gibraltar down if we ensure that we are ready for whatever Brexit and the Commons throws at us. We must continue, we will continue, and we do continue in these times of unprecedented flux to plan for every eventuality now. For that reason, today, the government has published a bill amending the Tobacco Act of 1997, allowing the collector to publish minimum retail prices of tobacco. And the members will know that that is pursuant to one of the MOUs entered into in the context of the withdrawal agreement. And I've already given instructions, Mr. Speaker, for the drafting of whatever domestic legislation is necessary in order to give effect to the historic text treaty we have reached with Spain. As I've already stated, I welcome the text treaty, which I am confident will lead to putting an end to the irritating myth that Gibraltar is anything other than entirely cooperative when it comes to the exchange of tax information. This treaty and the cooperation it supports will put an end to that myth. Now, this afternoon, tabled a motion that honourable members may have seen to enable this House to note the existence of this tax treaty. I intend to lay it on the table and speak at the end of this statement also, so that it is formally before the House. Finally, Mr. Speaker, the past 48 hours in Westminster really have left me with a feeling of politics and democracy being practiced almost as an extreme sport for thrill seekers. But we must hold our nerve and we must hold our heads up high and we must hold on for any result. For we must hope for development that enable us at best to remain in the European Union or at the very worst to leave as with a deal. And in doing so, we must be clear that reports of Mrs. May's political demise have been premature before. We have heard for the better part of the year, in sometimes pretty distasteful terms, how she has entered the kill zone, how this is held with reckoning, etc., etc. We heard it week after week. And yet she may still emerge as a Rocky Balboa type with a last-second victory for her deal. But if it came to it, and we were asked for our advice, what I would say to all colleagues in Westminster is that the best way to take back control of the process of leaving would be to revoke the Article 50 notification and remove the EU's ability to pressure the United Kingdom. Mr. Speaker, after the events of the past 48 hours, the government today will only be able to deal with two bills. I expect to be able to come back to the House next Thursday to deal with other bills and other mechanisms which may need to be put in place in time for the vote leaving on the 29th of March, if that was still the date by which we leave, and because every eventuality is on the table, we must prepare for that. Mr. Speaker, I'm sure that the clerk will enjoy the support of the whole House if he has to quickly plan for European parliamentary elections. I'm sure it would be a problem we would all like to have, and that we will all lend him our support by registering early and voting early also if it came to that. Mr. Speaker, I think at this stage that is all I can meaningfully say to the House in respect of the events of the past week and in particular of the past 48 hours. I know that all other members will want to know what happens this evening in Westminster, which may deal with at least a further part of the conundrum of how Brexit will be resolved, finally falling into place.
The Honourable Member of the Opposition.
Mr. Speaker, we are grateful for the Chief Minister's statement in relation to updating this House as to the events that have happened over the last couple of days. In London, of course, this is a period of unprecedented flux, as the Chief Minister has said. And quite clearly, the discipline in Westminster has completely broken down to the extent that we now see the Prime Minister voting against her own amendment, Mr. Speaker. We must, as the Chief Minister, continue to prepare for all potential outcomes and all possibilities that occur as a result of tonight's vote. And we cannot, of course, go without a comment in relation to the government's position throughout this process. We have reserved judgment in respect of the handling and management of this process, together with the positions adopted by the Chief Minister in relation to the Whitfield Agreement, for example, which has been both rejected conclusively by the UK Parliament, indeed twice now. And no one will forget the comments by the Chief Minister in November this year, in which he overtly supported the Mr. May's agreement, and was probably the only person to do so, Mr. Speaker. But in relation to the Chief Minister's comments in relation to tax, we have prepared, of course, to respond in some way to the tax increases, Mr. Speaker, but we are grateful for the indication of the Chief Minister that he has filed a motion within which we can substantively disturb. Substantially debate the question of the tax treaty, and what we cautiously welcome the Chief Minister's statement we will watch to see in relation to tonight. But one last thought would be, of course, for the general population. And so there's the comments we receive on this item, and I'm sure the Chief Minister and his team receive in relation to a very real concern up and down Main Street and in relation to our people and the businesses who are concerned about the consequences of Brexit. Are concerned about our exit from the European Union and the impact on their personal lives, their tax affairs, and indeed their businesses. And it's been reaffirmed by the Chief Minister and his reply to the member directly who are genuinely held concerns about the future of them and their families.
Mr.
Speaker, I too thank the Chief Minister for his statement this afternoon. The last 48 hours have indeed been unprecedented in the United Kingdom to an extent that we haven't seen since post-war Britain. Mrs. May's deal has been defeated. Her own cabinet ministers have rebelled against her, herself in her own motion, and Parliament is in total chaos. First, we heard that no deal was better than a bad deal, then we heard that a deal is better than no deal, and now we're talking about extension. The United Kingdom seems to be throwing motions and votes as well, Mr. Speaker, about it. The EU doesn't actually have a final say, or isn't actually even on board. This is something that seems to be forgotten these days in Westminster. So the fact of the matter is that because of that, the UK could easily be sleepwalking into a no-deal scenario come 29th of March. So, Mr. Speaker, this political thriller still hasn't seen the end of the series, and my concerns, as I've said before, and needing clarification from this statement, is due to the reality that the government has been championing Mrs. May's deal, and it's something that can be understood considering that, you know, we're talking about the government of the UK, and the government is also lobbying and working with the government of the UK to achieve the best deal possible. But the fact of the matter is that there is a possibility of a no deal, and we do have situations that need clarifying. For example, as I raised back in December, the issue of border inspection points, the issue of food and perishables, which I was told at the time was a zero issue. Today seems to be a possibility to become a massive issue, and we still don't have clarity. Businesses are reporting that there is no information being given to them. Mothers, fathers, children need clarity, need to know what is going to be happening. And unfortunately, it seems that we have been putting all our eggs in one basket, but not in parallel, and at the same time, organizing Plan B, Plan C, and Plan D, because we don't know which one could transpire. So, Mr. Speaker, I kindly ask the Chief Minister to clarify how much contingency planning is going on and offer more information to this community to put us at ease that the government is budgeting and dealing with every eventuality that could easily transpire. Thank you.
On previous occasions when you have made a statement, you have replied one by one. I will then after you reply to the Honourable Marina Hassanana, I will call upon Mr. Anderson to answer the question.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I have no difficulty with that way of progressing.
I'm grateful for Honourable Member's intervention. The Honourable Mr. Phillips was not a member of the Brexit Select Committee, although he is now the leader of the opposition. And the DUP has not asked that we should replace another one of the members that they have in the Brexit Select Committee with him. I said that they reserve judgment on the work that the government has done. Well, I think it must be this reserving judgment. Because a number of other members of the DUP have said overtly, to use his terminology, that the Hoover government has left no stone unturned in the work that we have done to protect Gibraltar. In fact, although he's not a member of the Brexit Committee, the Honourable Deputy Minister reminds me that we extended to him the courtesy of a briefing in respect of all our planning for a no deal. So, you can reserve judgment as much as you like, but there are, on the record, statements of support from other members opposite. He will allow me, Mr. Speaker, given how he decided that he was going to, in effect, attack the way that the government has handled the negotiations in respect of our departure from the European Union, our involuntary departure from the European Union, he will allow me to tell him that if there's a lack of discipline in Westminster and voting does not go as one expects, well, all that happens is between on this side of the House and he reminds us of what it was like to see them voting for the budget 2 years ago. Or rather, some of them not voting for the budget 2 years ago, and others leaving and voting for the budget 2 years ago, although some of them have gone back since then. So, I won't take lessons on overt support for measures from him. But let's be very clear, Mr. Speaker. I am entirely comfortable to have negotiated for Gibraltar a strand of protection in the event of the United Kingdom leaving the European Union with a deal. Entirely comfortable. Indeed, I am not just comfortable about it, I am proud of it. Because all the members will recall that the opening position of the European Union with the encouragement of Spain and in order to support Spain was that the United Kingdom was leaving the European Union, that they would negotiate a deal for the United Kingdom to leave with a deal, but that Gibraltar would not form part of that deal. And we have negotiated for Gibraltar, conceding nothing in the process that we could form part of that deal. None of us want to leave the European Union, at least none of us on this side. I know that the bear executive is bitterly divided on this issue. And I've seen in publications, and I've seen on public social media, that members of their executive want us to leave as soon as possible. Right. We are good at this house, I'm telling you, United and not wanting to leave. That doesn't mean I value the support of those on that side of the house who are clearly also supportive of remaining in the European Union of Europe. But it appears, although we don't know what's going to happen in the next half an hour, that the United Kingdom is leaving the European Union. It appears that that will now be with a deal, not without a deal. And it appears, Mr. Speaker, because of the work that we have done for Gibraltar, we have the benefit of that deal. Because what the other member needs to realize is that he needed to have been in the question, sitting in my chair, considering the possibility that the United Kingdom leading to the European Union against our wishes, take up with them the benefit for itself of a transitional period of deal with the European Union, and we do not have the benefit of that. We would have been the worst territory in Europe for which to do business as a result. So when I say overt support to the withdrawal agreement, it was because that withdrawal agreement contained parts negotiated by me and the Gibraltar team, including the Deputy Minister, the Attorney General of Gibraltar, the Financial Secretary of Gibraltar, none of us known for our desire to make any concessions on anything. Anyone that can say. And in order to protect Gibraltar from the eventuality that the United Kingdom might leave with a deal and not have the benefit of it.
because if they thought, for one moment, that it was wise to see the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom negotiate the withdrawal agreement, which provided for a conditional period on withdrawal, and not to negotiate for the inclusion of Gibraltar, which is what would have happened if we hadn't moved, then, Mr. Speaker, there would have been a withdrawal agreement, the UK would have had the benefit of the transition, and we would not. So, when the withdrawal agreement was done, the direction of travel was to depart. As it is today, although it may be other ways, the direction of travel is to depart. We have to ensure that withdrawal agreement was provided for Gibraltar and protected Gibraltar, because the withdrawal agreement was, and not the other one. So it is that they don't fear, if the withdrawal agreement is reopened, that there is a possibility that all matters may be renegotiated, including Gibraltar matters. Because if they don't understand that, Mr. Speaker, they really are not in a position to make informed decisions about this economy or indeed this community. So, I don't see, Mr. Speaker, noble gentlemen, thinking, I think, he was making a possible point that might be advantageous to him, gave me the opportunity to remind people how important of the work we have done has been to ensure that we were part of the withdrawal agreement, and why we were right then, and we would be right now to support that withdrawal agreement, if the United Kingdom is going to leave, and if it is going to leave with a deal. The other gentleman said that he's come ready to talk to the tax treaty. Well, I'm very pleased that he has come ready to tax treaty. So have I. I'm ready to talk to the tax treaty. I'm looking forward to having a discussion about the tax treaty. I know that there are many commentators in Spain who are very, very, very disappointed with the tax treaty and what Gibraltar has achieved in it. And I know there's one or two commentators in Gibraltar who are not in this house. Who have said things about the tax treaty which are unfavorable, but I suppose in part to everybody all of the time, especially those who are held bent in not being good. I have no difficulty with that. Indeed, Mr. Speaker, I support the fact that there should be people who make foolish points so that we can address them. And I don't mean the honorable member because he's made no points yet in talking about those outside the house. I shall meet him when he makes this point, no doubt. The old member says then, from the position of replying to a government statement, where we've been living with this at every moment, we'll watch and wait and grateful for that level of honesty. Because that is what the honourable member, is doing. He's just watching and waiting. We've held hundreds of meetings, traveled hundreds of thousands of air miles, conducted myriad negotiations, secured the Gibraltar's position, protected our businesses, ensured that our economy was going to be able to continue to function, and not just function, but flourish, and we keep watching and waiting. Which is, perhaps, given the fact that this party has even proposed him for the Brexit Select Committee, exactly what one would expect. There's a Spanish saying that says that the bulls are best seen from the other side of the barrier. And that is why the honourable gentleman is doing the bullfight that is Brexit. And I commend to him that he's still on the other side of the barrier. But then he says, we're working on this, and we're concerned about the consequences of what might happen for the Brexit. How can we then not be pleased that we have dealt with the consequences, both in the context of a withdrawal agreement, so that there is the benefit of transition, but we have dealt with the consequences in the context of no deal, because the honourable gentleman would have seen the whole of what the Labour has been issued in Spain, some of the contingency measures issued by the European Union, etc. And indeed, Mr. Speaker, be very pleased by the fact that even no deal appears now to have been justified. And what we can do is say, I condemn you for being overly supportive of the withdrawal agreement, but I'm concerned about what happens to Gibraltar. Well, I'm just being able to ensure in the withdrawal agreement that we're protected. So you need to understand that logically the things that you say cannot be justified and make sense. And then the speaker, he says that he's worried about the future for Gibraltar, he's worried about Gibraltarians and their families, etc. from a figure, and I will say this both to the Honourable Gentleman and to the Honourable Lady, who has said these people said about mothers, fathers, and children. A figure. My mind, my heart, every sinew of my body, and every kilojoule of energy that I have used since the morning of the 24th of June of 2016 has been engaged in protecting mothers, fathers, children, people who may not be mothers or fathers, every soul that lives in Gibraltar and indeed those who come to work in Gibraltar and make Gibraltar's economy a success. We have protected them in the context of the withdrawal. We have protected them in the context of no deal. We have ensured that the future of Gibraltar is not in any doubt. Our economic relationship with the European Union is in doubt, and we mustn't fall into the hyperbole that the Spanish would want us to fall into, and I only see this in the Spanish press, but say that the future of Gibraltar is in doubt. No, the future of Gibraltar is not in doubt. The future of Gibraltar's sovereignty is not in doubt. The future of Gibraltar's economy is not in doubt. The future of our prosperity is not in doubt. All of that will be secured. A second of these days, which all agree that we are part of it. What is in doubt is our relationship with the European Union. Now, if I was talking in Westminster, I would say our biggest trading partner. Our biggest trading partner is the United Kingdom. We have protected that trade in our relationship with the United Kingdom until 2020 and indeed for thereafter as well. The other thing I might say, others who haven't secured our relationship with the European Union to be the same as the UK after 2020. Well, now it comes to the UK. Because the European Union has said, we're not going to talk about that until after we've left. As a conclusion, they say, we will talk about it before we've left if we sign the withdrawal agreement, and we're just in the process of implementation. But the United Kingdom hasn't signed the withdrawal agreement. So, the other gentleman might not say whatever he likes, but we cannot judge him falsely for not having a team in a negotiation that the other side of the negotiation has said it is not prepared to start yet with the United Kingdom, a slightly larger nation than Gibraltar. That's what he said. But I will give you one assurance, when the time comes and that negotiation starts, the position of the government of Gibraltar will not have changed by the time it ends. In other words, we will not make any concession whatsoever, as we have not done today, in respect of sovereignty, jurisdiction, or control over Gibraltar. And I will take on all comers who want to have a debate on that subject when the time comes, when those provisions kick in, looking line by line, full stop by full stop, comma by comma, and as Joe McFarlane taught me and every other Gibraltarian, letter by letter, because even issues of plurality in the Brussels Agreement we learned could have different meanings in one language and another. And I will take on all commas that care to be deployed on behalf of Montevideo or elsewhere to suggest that a cabinet involving any of the 10 members sitting on the side, including those two who are away on government business, the Minister for Sport in the Middle East with our fantastic Special Olympians and the Minister for Equality in New York on matters related to equality, and on her way also to Abu Dhabi. Indeed, a team involving Jose Garcia or Joe Bassano, and indeed the one who made concessions within the context of those individuals. He is not right, therefore, the future of the Gibraltarian, their family, or indeed for any profession. Mr. Speaker, I think the Honourable Lady captured the feeling that I was trying to convey about the high stakes game that appears to be played in Westminster and the fact that Mrs. May ended up if she put it rebelling against herself by voting against the motion that the state would convey. I mean, it's absolutely true And the older lady is making a point that I made and that Jacob was not makes. So we are strange bedfellows with an outspread material. Namely that the default position still remains at the United Kingdom being from the 29th of March under UK law and under the arrangements of the European Union, unless UK law is changed and unless the European Union can seek an extension or the Article 50 notification is revoked. And therefore, we have to be ready for those eventualities. That's what I'm talking about today. So, when he perfectly understood why I was championing Mrs. May's ideas, I think he also wanted to reflect the fact that it was important. I think he said as much. I'm grateful for that. But he then went on to suggest that some of our no deal planning is not as bulletproof as honourable members would have wanted. Well, he had been briefed privately on some of the topics that he's now asking questions about. So I wouldn't be circumspect about what I say because honourable members will understand that if we're doing contingency planning, it's because we fear that a third party, the European Union or a part of it, is going to try and take steps which might be negative for Gibraltar and we need to avoid them. So if I put out there what we're doing to avoid them, then I will be playing into the hands of those seeking to do those things. And on the issue of the border inspection post in particular, Mr. Speaker, the position of the government remains exactly as we set out to do. Indeed, it's improved. I told her that this would be zero issue. This is now a zero minor issue. The border inspection post has been dealt with entirely satisfactorily. In the context of discussions we have with the European Union, because the measure is a common agricultural policy measure, which never applied to the world, and because the issues that obtain are issues relating to the taking of perishable goods, in particular those originating in the European Union. Now, there is only one minor issue there, and that issue doesn't relate to the exportation to the world of European goods, perishable European goods. It obtains from the respect of the ability of goods to exit the United Kingdom, which will then be certainly a third country, be imported into the European Union, and then be exported from the European Union. We also have a clause, Mr. Speaker, in respect of the second exportation, in other words, the exportation from the European Union to the world. The difficulty will be the first exportation, the exportation from the United Kingdom into the European Union, if there are issues, well beyond the frontiers, up alleyways, etc. If there is a traffic jam there, now, there's precious little that we can do about that, but that does not go to fundamentals. The way that I've expressed it before, the honourable lady will have heard me express it in some of the briefings she has had, is that the core function of government is to ensure there is food in our shops, and that we are able to admit to Gibraltar in general. It is not that we should have probably Marmite or a particular type of Scottish beef that there should be meat. Now, if there is a difficulty with goods being exported to the United Kingdom to continental Europe, then that is something which I think would be a blip. I think even in the context of an age of Brexit, it would be a short-lived thing whilst those mechanisms are resolved. So therefore, Mr. Speaker, in that context, we don't need to dramatize more than is necessary for ourselves a very dramatic situation already by talking about worrying about mothers and fathers and children, etc. And let's also remember that there are people who are neither mothers nor fathers, and we mustn't ignore them. Looking after the interests of every Gibraltarian does not require us to worry about the ability to victual Gibraltar. That is not an issue. I told them it was a zero issue before, it is now a minor zero issue. Now, she says that therefore all our things are in one basket. Because she knows from the briefings she's had, all our things are not in one basket. The Civil Contingency Committee has been fully engaged. The Minister of Defence has engaged with the Government of Gibraltar. There are many strands to what we will be doing. There are many routes into Gibraltar which are not just the frontier, in case the assurances we have received and even the laws that have been passed are not adhered to. And we are the press of a button away from those routes being able to be engaged the morning after they were not needed, it's disgraceful that you spend taxpayers' money on something that in effect you wasted and you thrown away. So the balance is being changed so that we are ready and able to engage those resources without having engaged them, because that is not going to be necessary. So I think that on the surface, we want to think that we have done what we needed to do in order to be able to do this community that guarantees it means without having failed in our duty as guardians of the public purse and that. And practically, we're another point to have another point of view. Thank you very much. Mr. Speaker, I have two questions, but before I deal with the questions, I want to deal with some of the things that the Honourable Chief Minister has said, because it's referring directly to me in some of the statements that I have made previously. This is the second point that I have said, that the government has left no stone unturned in lobbying exercises in the United Kingdom and elsewhere. And indeed, I said that he wrote to both himself and also the Deputy Chief Minister, and I've spoken to everybody that the government needed to speak to. That's what I said. I have made absolutely no comment at all in relation to the memorandum of understanding. There are a number of reasons for that, not least because it's not my area of responsibility. If I were asked, indeed, I'm going to make my touch upon it. Has the government made concessions in relation to the memorandum of understanding? Yes, the government has made concessions. This is not where the government has made concessions, or the government has not made concessions. Because when the negotiations of that sort, you expect there to be an element of give and take. The issue is whether, taking into account what the government has gained, in other words, the extra 2 years, or for example, the extra 2 years, and the ability of that group to reposition the economy, etc., which we spoke about previously, whether what the government has given up, or given, not given up, but given, is justified. Would you agree taking opposition? And the government has taken a different position. But I will say this, that all that, in other words, the exchanges and the different sorts of opinion across the floor of this house could have been avoided if the government had accepted my advice from the beginning, which was to include the opposition in the process. And I said that not only because I believe that is the right way of undertaking politics, particularly, and look, I have to say that may sound strange coming from somebody that likes a bit of a scrap dialogue. But something that's important is this, and with the challenges that we as a collective community face, I think it was important for, and it was an occasion where the government and the opposition ought to have worked together in order to find that and set that roadmap for the community. I also said it because I don't believe that actually it's in anybody's interest, still left in the voters' interest, for those to be in political exchanges on issues of this importance. So there are a lot of things that we're going to look at, and we're going to approach and blame for that. Look, the government has got to take its share of responsibility, because the government did not include the opposition in that process from the very beginning. It was when I arrived, the honourable gentleman, in good faith, and he knew that the advice that I have provided him has been in good faith. What I have said, Mr. Speaker, publicly, and the way connected, in fact, the honourable gentleman made a contribution to the Times when he asked MP the question to support the withdrawal agreement. I came out the day later with a letter to the Times, arguing that I didn't think that the withdrawal agreement was good for Vivian. So they were connected, by the way. I wasn't responding to the honourable gentleman in the international press. They were completely unconnected, and I didn't know that the honourable gentleman was going to be making a contribution when I submitted my letter. But what I did say, and what my position had been, or the public statements that I had made on the withdrawal agreement, but what about the MOU? That they did comment on the MOU. Had been that actually looking at it, I didn't think the withdrawal agreement, that very negotiated, this is nothing to do with the was good for Gibraltar because all it really does is it binds Gibraltar 2 years, but the reality is that Spain is going to block a permanent agreement applying to Gibraltar without having its counterplay. And therefore, actually, I thought that as a community, all of us, what we should have been doing was attempting to persuade MPs at Westminster to try and, the course of action that I had on social media and in my current relevance as a mere mortal in the opposition, basis, a referendum on Mrs. May's deal, be the referendum on three options, a May deal or no deal, to remain as a man. And I think that we ought to have done that. That's not intended as a criticism of him, it's what I personally believe we ought to have done. And I think that having dealt with that, and I hope that I wasn't going to be making a preamble of that sort, but I really did feel that I've got to respond to the Chief Minister's comment about what I have said in the past. I would ask the Chief Minister two questions. The first is, there is a difference between withdrawing the Article 50, which the UK can do unilaterally, and that would mean that the United Kingdom and Gibraltar and remain part of the EU, and the United Kingdom extending or asking for an extension, because asking for an extension depends on, or the viability of it depends on, the 27 EU member states agreeing to it. How confident is he that Spain is not going to put the kibosh on the extension applying to Gibraltar? And indeed, have you received any assurances from the United Kingdom government that the United Kingdom government would reject that tooth and nail? The other question that I would ask is, if Mrs. May's withdrawal agreement goes by the wayside and the protocol, therefore goes by the wayside, is my understanding correct that memorandums of understanding will also go by the wayside? And I'd also, I'm quite cognizant that there's going to be a debate in relation to this. What about the tax treaty? Is the tax treaty, does the tax treaty, as I understand it to be, does it stand separate to the withdrawal of the European Union? Those are my things. Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker.
So, Mr. Speaker, I'm grateful to the Honourable Gentleman for having clarified what it is that he said in the past. So I'm not grateful, therefore, for his support of his saying that he is not given it. I thought he had, and I've been particularly gentle with him, Mr. Speaker, in the past year as a result. But of course, I never take his word for what he says he has said, and I will go back and look at everything that he said that he has said. Because I think he may have said something that was a little further than what he said that he's saying today. So, it's not really true, though, that he said that he left no stone unturned in our lobby. I think he's gone a little further also. And it's also true that he said nothing in relation to the MOUs. I wasn't suggesting that he had. I was not suggesting that he said anything positive. I was talking about the negotiations there, not the MOUs. Let's be clear, Mr. Speaker. He said, in his analysis, that we have made concessions in the context of the MOUs. I say we haven't. But he said, well, whatever you have, I'm not saying that's wrong. I'm saying, what is the calculation that we end up with when we put on the balance those concessions I say we've made versus what we have achieved? And we've only achieved it for 2 years, and therefore, he leads us to the conclusion that he thinks we've made concessions which have been made for a not sufficient return. Well, of course, if he were making an argument, I see that he's shaking his head now, although that's what he said, he would be wrong even by
incorrect logic, because the conceptions are contained only in the memorandums of understanding by this understanding of conceptions, because we see none in them, which are coterminous in time with the period of 2 years, which is what we have attained. And so, although we wrongly say that we conceived anything, if we have conceived anything, we only conceived it for the two-year period, which is the only thing in his analysis that we have attained in return, therefore. So it would be, in effect, a balance of what he says, up until then, which I cannot for one moment see, and I'm quite happy to do a more detailed analysis when the time comes by motion, and the reason I'm not before the House yet is because there is as yet nothing to consider because there's no return agreement. But I'm happy to do it, as I say, line by line, poster by poster, comma by comma, the third of those representations, that there are the 2 years. That's the first point. You will forgive me if this far down the road in my political career, I don't start taking this advice now. For a simple reason. First of all, Mr. Speaker, he's never taken mine, which is probably why he's sitting over there and I'm sitting over here. And second, Mr. Speaker, his advice is always contrary to the things that he does. And the things that he proudly defends. So, for example, he says, in a moment of national crisis of this sort, you must involve your business in the second energy. He joined the GSD, Mr. Speaker, when the joint sovereignty issues were in play, and we were excluded. So, it's a part of that. Oh, right. Okay. So, he was not in the GSD at the time of joint sovereignty, but he was in the GSD. And in 2002-2003, the GSD, during the time of joint sovereignty, did not involve the then GSW Liberal Opposition in any of the determinations that it made. It didn't even extend confidential briefings of what was going on. It successfully dealt with the issue of joint sovereignty, Mr. Speaker, without involving the opposition. So the GSD now says, but that's a long time ago, and no difference to us. So, but Mr. Speaker, that might be the case. But they are not different to what they were. And they are telling us that we should do it in that way. Look, if we had done it in that way, we would have been the different ones who did it in a different way. But they cannot tell us to do it in a different way, because they were the ones who did it in that way. And Mr. Speaker, that GSD has a percentage advantage over the GSD, which is not a 36% lead in the result of the election. So, you're not getting some sense. We enjoy more than the support of 2/3 of the population at the last election. And nobody knows what we enjoy the next election, and the honorable lady might give that she doesn't know what the whole team enjoys the next election. Right? None of us know. That's a lie. But we are here on the basis of the results announced after the last election. And we have more than 2/3 of the support of the vote in that sense. So we are legitimized in being able to take these decisions. But however, because we are in the end, and because we didn't do things in the way that they did them at the time of joint sovereignty, we involve them in briefings so that they can know what is going on. And the Honourable Deputy Minister, who is a man of deep principle, in every meeting of the Regulatory Committee has asked the members attending, is there anything you think we should be doing that we haven't done? Is there anything you think that we should pursue? Anyone you think we should talk to who we haven't spoken to? And honourable members, and the last thing, rather than Mr. Fitzgerald, I think on one occasion we wanted to refer to the suggestion of the ministry. Honourable members did not say a peep. Did not say a peep. So we did change the way we did things from the way that they did them in joint sovereignty time. Because we are in the zone and we do things differently. But given the case that the honourable gentleman has reminded me of, it is also true that honourable members, including him, when members of the GOP executive
at the time of the Cordoba Agreement. Agreement of which we learned when the Republic in a local newspaper, or news as it is now, on the website of a Spanish newspaper before their public in the Congress of a Spanish newspaper. The text speaking was first made in Gibraltar, who was first published in Gibraltar, for the terms of the text. Let's be very clear about that. Now, you can't work off the responsibility of what was happening in 2006 and the lack of our involvement, although those did involve the festival, especially at the airport. And if we had been involved, our views might not have been too welcome about this. And in particular, you cannot serve responsibility in that respect because I have on my desk, because I was reading for other purposes the other day, the first festival of the Cordoba Agreement, saying that the opposition is supposed to criticize the agreements because they are opposing for the sake of opposing. And of course, one of the people that he says is doing that, and he names him, is the current leader of the party that he sits in. That's the opposition. The current leader of the party that he sits in, that is then criticizing the party that he sits in. Not having involved people in the context of those negotiations, but by indictment. I'm preparing to understand every aspect that is relevant, every full stop, and every comma of what has been done, why it has been done, and why it is properly done, and what is different to what was done before. Although, the honorable members need read no more, no less than the magnificent principle that the honorable gentleman just the person of the Honourable Gentleman, the knight that the Honourable Gentleman refers to as the greatest libertarian of all time, goes to viewpoint some weeks ago when he explains the difference between one and the other. I'll leave it at that. I know you think it's a bit of a problem with interest in the party political exchange about these things, and quickly embarked on a party political exchange about these things. The Honourable Gentleman is even in the moment in which he is giving advice, and giving it, and doing the opposite. So I don't have to go back 5 years to, or 10 years to demonstrate that. He is the living embodiment of that contradiction of advice versus action. And then we wrote to the Times, Mr. Speaker, because we believe that Mrs. Mayfield, which is typical to her, thankfully, not to me, some suggestion is that she's not to me, but to work with that advice, which is also not to me, he says that he wrote in the Times, because he believes the referendum was better than moratorium. Well, Speaker, but I believe that remaining is better than leaving, whether with your agreement or without it. But if we're leaving, and the United Kingdom government is even today, at this time, in the Commons, saying that we're leaving, I believe it's better to leave with a moratorium. Now, a referendum is an opportunity to say, but it's another roll of the dice. And the sound of it. It's another roll of the dice, which could result in us leaving, and potentially even without leaving. So that's why, because I prefer the idea of a revocation and some sense in putting the money to have a second referendum, and perhaps resolving this issue another way, and remaining full stop. But honourable members must never try to caricature my support for the return agreement if we are leaving, as my support for leaving versus remaining. The only people in Gibraltar who I have seen supporting leaving versus remaining are members of the executive and honorable members of the government. And they say on their dividend all the time, I suppose, Mr. Speaker, that is why the honorable gentleman still has a claim to the citizens that the best is relevant time. I know, I think the only one who's had public. I know the only one who's had public, Mr. Speaker, and so I've got that explained. The question then becomes, according to the honourable gentleman, what is it that we should have been doing in the United Kingdom? Should we be supporting the withdrawal agreement, given that the United Kingdom is leaving, or should we be arguing passionately for a referendum? Well, let's be careful. I think we all agree that the United Kingdom political debate at the moment is as convoluted, as polluted as it ever has been in history. It is really toxic in a way that one could not imagine that the mother of all parliaments and the mother of democracies would end up in the political debate. it is really quite nonsense. Members on both sides of the argument are having to have police protection. It's very primitive now. Don't worry about that. I already have police protection. I'm not saying it for that reason. I'm very good police protection in this case.
None of us would like to see, and hopefully the Commons will finally take the table
the MOU for the benefit of the separately Bulgarian and other EU citizens, including Spaniards, might be able to continue to apply for a defined period, likely until December 2020, so that we could create a transitional period. That is not yet entirely finalized, and I hope it's worth it will no longer have to proceed because of the common decision that it has taken over, like eventually we can find ourselves in that situation. So tax season is different, and I've expressed that already in the context of the public statements I've made in respect to the tax season. I am very, very, very pleased indeed with what we have achieved with the tax season. All the members will have seen my public statements in that respect. Spanish commentators are very displeased with what has been achieved by Gibraltar in the tax season. Indeed, some Spanish commentators are saying that Spain might want to consider now finally dropping its coin to Gibraltar as a result of what it has conceded in their interpretation in the tax treaty. And therefore, it's not something that I want to see so, by the way, but something that I hope will endure, so that one of the most irritating myths of the Spanish sold to their own people and then sought to ensure those around the world, which is that we don't share information and we don't cooperate in tax matters, is completely busted by that tax treaty. So that will endure whatever the position in respect of the reform agreement, or indeed, even if there is no Brexit. A lot of the provisions in the reform agreement, sorry, in the tax treaty, are already provided for in the context of the continued declaration of EU law. They already apply. A lot of the exchange of information is already provided today to Spain and all other EU states under the existing EU provisions. Some members might shake their heads, but that's the provision. Exchanges and automatic exchanges of information between all member states. So, honourable members will, I think, if they do a genuine analysis, whatever it is that they then say publicly, it's not a matter. I mean, that's a matter entirely to them, and they'll do that publicly when they really want to. I'm very clear that this tax treaty will endure, that there will be a general narrative they will see that this is on for today.
Honourable Clay Clinton.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I have a couple of questions that you can say specifically in relation to the tax treaty. And I want to start off by Mr. Speaker by in fact agreeing with the excellent number of reasons. Mr. Speaker, I'm able to answer questions in the things I've said in my statement, my original statement, not the things I've said afterwards. I am not able to answer detailed questions on the tax treaty. Indeed, I don't think I am required to answer detailed questions on the tax treaty at this stage. I will answer these questions on the tax treaty when we have the motions on the tax treaty. This is a very technical treaty. The financial secretary is not with me this afternoon. He is the person who I rely on for interpretation of sections of the tax treaty. So if he's going to ask me detailed questions about the operation of the tax treaty, I invite him to do so in writing, and I will endeavour to reply in detail. If he wants to ask me political questions about the tax treaty, I will try and deal with those. But the tax treaty is not before the House. My statement about what happened in Parliament in the past 48 hours is before the House.
The treaty is not in the public domain because it hasn't yet been laid on the table. It is going to be laid. It hasn't been laid on the table. The treaty is very going to be laid on the table. We have already given notice of a motion which is couched in neutral terms, and which will give the honourable member every opportunity to raise whatever matter he wishes to. That would be the appropriate time, and there is no need to anticipate the details of the tax treaty now.
I'm grateful for the guidance, but I won't actually go into delve into the details of the tax treaty. I was merely going to ask the Minister two particular points in relation to the statement he's already made about the tax treaty. I appreciate that there is a motion before the House, of which we only got notice this afternoon. And I would have thought from the record that the tax treaty is in fact in the public domain and hadn't been published by them. I think we agree on that point. What I'm going to say to the Chief Minister was that I agree with him in that the tax treaty is not, as we know, corrupted in the past, a double tax treaty. It is a tax treaty, but not a double double tax treaty as people who work in a single tax would call it. My question to you, Jonathan, is in relation to tax treaty in a possibility which we issued, saying you've obtained a commitment from the Israeli government that the effective implementation of this treaty will lead to the water being removed from the past process of tax haven jurisdictions in the future. I want to know what form that commitment was in, and especially given comments in the New People this week saying that if Spain does not remove us from the tax treaty, then the water has reserved its position to access this treaty. I'd be grateful for two things of thought on that particular matter, namely exactly what commitments have been received from the Spanish government, and what would it do if they do not remove us from the blacklist. And secondly, Mr. Speaker, my second question is really about process, and that is, when will this treaty come into effect? Because my basic reading of it is it isn't in effect yet, and there's a process to be followed, and I'd be grateful for Chief Minister's thoughts as to what the process is, and when we expect this treaty to be in place. And in terms of domestic legislation, will the incentives used up by regulation, or will there be primary legislation as it enters this house? Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I'm grateful for the Honourable Gentleman understanding that I'm not equipped to deal with detailed questions about the tax treaty. And I know that those detailed questions, because I've had extensive discussions with the Finance and Council, the accountants and lawyers, amongst others, go through every letter and every word in the treaty, because that's how they will be interpreted and that's how the treaty has been negotiated. I now know a lot about the difference between spend and spend. Which is as important in tax matters as the difference between issue and issue when it comes to sovereignty. That comes from the hard work that has been done by the Financial Secretary, by the Commissioner of Income Tax, John Lester, and by Crown Council, Senior Crown Council, Chairman Spoker, in respect to these negotiations, together with the rest of the negotiations team members and the Attorney General, the Deputy Minister, and me. So, it is therefore exactly right to say that this is not a double taxation agreement. And the Honourable Gentleman has tried to ask me whether it was a double taxation agreement. I told him that it wasn't a double taxation agreement. It is an agreement by which each of the taxing authorities commit themselves to give unilateral double taxation relief. So instead of being a double taxation agreement where that is set out, both parties say, I will unilaterally give relief. That is to set in treaty stone what is happening at the moment, but which could stop at any time that either the taxing authorities were to decide not to continue to unilaterally give that relief. That is not so relevant in the context of Gibraltar, because we have a handful of people who live in Gibraltar and work in Spain, and the tax rate which applies to them as individuals is higher in Spain over here. So there would be no additional tax to integrate it. So it is, of course, hugely important in respect of frontier workers from Spain to Gibraltar, whatever the nationality they may be, because they come to Gibraltar, they work and are taxed in Gibraltar, because the Gibraltarian system of taxation is like the UK system of taxation, it's a source of income, so it's taxes income at source, and therefore we tax the earnings here. When the frontier workers go across Spain, they are then taxed on the difference between the taxes that they would be subjected to if they were taxed only in Spain. So to give a rough example, if a worker is subject to a rate of 25% tax in Gibraltar, on his earnings, his or her earnings, he pays that tax, he goes to Spain where he lives, there in Spain he would have to pay 30% of tax. He pays only 15% of tax, that is to say the difference, because the Spanish authorities unilaterally give that relief. There is no right to that relief at the moment, and the Spanish authorities could have said, well, you have to take 40% here, in which case the rate payable is 65%. And there have been instances of attempts to do that around the world and in Spain, and that would be very negative indeed for those who come to Gibraltar to work, and to work in Gibraltar would then not be attracted. This creates a right to that unilateral relief. Therefore, maintaining the attraction of
agriculture has faced the West. The second point that the Honourable Gentleman makes is what commitment we have from the Spanish government in respect of removal from Black Britain. He quotes there a recent publication called The New People, which would make the former editor of The New People, Juan Carlos Pérez, a close, loved friend of all of us on this side of the house, very pleased indeed to hear that publication mentioned with such authority in this house by the Honourable Member, as if things mentioned in The New People are the reflecting what the government has said, and I said it in my statement, and it's in the short video that I was asked to prepare for the government website. That term of that reference to removal from the Black Book should emerge in the process of rectification. We know the language of the treaty, we have agreed it should emerge in the process of ratification of the treaty in the Spanish Parliament, so they therefore reliable to it. What it provides for will be put out there. I'm quite happy to share with the Honourable Gentleman the text of that commitment behind it, to have it with me. But I don't think it's right that I should publish the text which we have agreed should come from the Spanish authorities in that respect. They must be the ones publishing. And indeed, it will not be effective until they use that terminology. And for that reason, the people that I've reserved is the government's right to terminate if they don't comply with the commitments that they have told us they are going to enter into. And the process of ratification of the treaty is a matter on which many interpretations could be written. In the United Kingdom, there is one process, in Spain, there is another process. In the United Kingdom, an explanatory memorandum is prepared by the relevant minister, in this case, the Minister for Europe is wearing the explanatory memorandum. The speaker is laid in the House. A period of time has passed, I think it's 14 days. After that, after which a fraction of time, the treaty is ratified, subject to the ratification by the other states that is relevant. In Spain, the parliamentary ratification process is not dissimilar. I think it is something that can be done after the election has been called, but it's not clear whether it can in fact happen, given the fact of nature of the majority in the Spanish Parliament that has been dissolved. So it's not clear whether we will have ratification pre the 28th of April or whether it will come after the 28th of April. In fact, it may not come if there is a different Spanish government that takes a different view. That is also possible, in which case you're not bound by it. And indeed, Mr. Speaker, if a Spanish government goes around the world saying they want to really share tax information, and they've got a treaty before their parliament to do so, which they haven't ratified, it makes their debate foolish and unfair position in relation to the information exchange and tax cooperation from Gibraltar even more impossible to do, because it wouldn't happen because they haven't ratified the treaty. And this information must always flow through gateways, and the taxpayers are entitled to confidentiality. There are European gateways through which information is already moving, and if they want other information, or at least they want the same information, but after we have been after we have left the European Union, then there needs to be a gateway before that, and that's what this treaty provides for. I'm sorry, can't be more helpful on the process of ratification of the treaty under Spanish law, but it's not a subject, and I feel the module on as well.
Any other questions?
Yeah, what's the government?
Speaker, maybe just for a couple of points of clarification on the statement made by the Chief Minister. Mr. Speaker, I noted that the Chief Minister referenced the tax treaty as being between Gibraltar and Spain. However, the treaty itself says that it's an international agreement on taxation and protection of financial interests between the Kingdom of Spain and the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland regarding Gibraltar. So I would like to understand better why the Chief Minister, and I'm not disagreeing that maybe with the assent of the Gibraltar
the government, but the treaty itself is between the United Kingdom and the Kingdom of Scotland. And the second point is just on the Chief Minister referenced earlier on the fact that all of the memorandums of understanding and indeed the tax treaty do not relinquish any rights with respect to or change the position of any party with respect to the position on sovereignty, jurisdiction and control. And I'm very glad that's the case. However, certainly in the case of the tax treaty, and I believe in the case of the protocol to the memorandum, the word control is missing. They refer to sovereignty and jurisdiction and the mixed control, and this is actually picked up by one of the local newspapers, edited by a member of a family of the government. And I would just like to understand again why the Chief Minister feels that he can insert control at that point when control isn't actually specifically mentioned in either the tax treaty or, I believe, the memorandum, the protocol for the memorandum. Excuse me.
The Prime Minister in the United Kingdom deals with as many points as I raised whenever she makes a statement. But I think she deals with a smaller percentage of members than I do, but it's a pleasure to have the opportunity to deal with the points of the government and the Speaker, on social media, Mr. Hammond has said that the government has made a huge concession in the setting of the past few years, more than just a grain of sand, and then promptly gone on not to identify any of what he says the concessions are. So, if the government has made something as important as a concession on sovereignty, jurisdiction, or control, one would have thought it was an obvious thing, but that would immediately have mentioned. But of course, as there is no concession in respect of sovereignty, jurisdiction, or control, I really welcome the opportunity that the Honourable Member gives me to raise these issues in this House and suggest them. Because there are no concessions whatsoever, either in the FCC or anywhere else. Let's be clear by starting with the title. This is an agreement between Gibraltar and Spain. Gibraltar, under the constitution that they recommended in the referendum of 2006, is not able to execute international tax treaties. We are able, under letter of entrustment, to execute agreements, like, for example, tax information exchange agreements, but not treaties. A treaty, in the second taxation, under Spanish law, has to be approved by the Spanish Parliament, because it alters the rights and obligations of individuals. The elevated is the equivalent of Spanish law. The treaty is ratified becomes Spanish law in respect of people who are subject to the Spanish tax net. And their rights in that respect and their obligations in that respect are governed by the treaty like their law. Their law is superior, but this is of the same standing as the law. Now, under the constitution that they recommended to us, they recall that the CCP did not give a recommendation in respect of the constitution. And the president is very proud of having been a member of that negotiating team. External relations remain with the United Kingdom. The signing of international tax treaties is a matter of external relations. But that doesn't mean that the agreement between the United Treasury and the Spanish Kingdom. These are the fact that the agreement is signed not by a UK Treasury Minister or a Spanish Treasury Minister. And indeed, the agreement says, the Honourable Gentleman says about sedentary position, Mr. Speaker. I know that they are sometimes stopped by the power of fact, but I will continue and be fair, Mr. Speaker. And so, this agreement is signed by the United Kingdom in that regard. In respect of Gibraltar, on behalf of Gibraltar. And it is, Mr. Speaker, exclusively in relation to the territory of Gibraltar, the authority of Gibraltar. And it creates a relationship between the tax authority of Gibraltar and the tax authority of Spain, the competent authority of
people from the competent authorities of Spain. So, I don't know how it is, because the Arbitrum has got it into its head that it is anything other than the agreement between Gibraltar and Spain. Signed for Gibraltar by the United Kingdom. And that's where the one is investment, therefore, that's what you have to say, Mr. Speaker. Because it's the United Kingdom that's signing. It would have been weirder,
or indeed, to quote Alice in Wonderland,
curiouser, if it had been signed by a UK minister,
who's the only one who can sign it, that's not true.
And it said, government of Gibraltar. I would say we have had huge consequences and objections to a document that said, government of Gibraltar, carrying a signature, which is not a signature of an official of the government of Gibraltar or a minister of the government of Gibraltar. It would be nonsensical. So we would have to test the propositions that they put before they put them. And so the agreement is properly entered into as an agreement between Gibraltar and Spain. Now, Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Gentleman then says, well, what is it that you have considered in respect of control, and why didn't you therefore have the word control in the treaty? Well, Mr. Speaker, it is very simple to understand. Democratic jurisdictional control is a political term of art. It is an attempt using three words to cover every iota of the territory and jurisdiction and sovereignty of Gibraltar and the control over it. Queen, one of the five thought appropriately by the former chief minister, dealing with that incursion into our territorial waters. Right now, sovereign jurisdiction and control is relevant to everything, but it is more relevant in places where others might seek to assume control because they're able to pretend to, like for example, in water, than it is in the second lap of Ireland, for example. So, sovereign jurisdiction and control is a political term. In a top treaty, control is not in play in any way. And so, that's what you say is you put the word control in the past treaty. You wouldn't put it in the treaty, is what I'm saying here. It's a political term of art, and therefore it fits in a statement about the treaty, but it doesn't fit in the treaty. In other words, go to any other tax treaty and find the word control when it comes to sovereignty, jurisdiction, or control in the context of sovereignty. And see if you find it. You won't find it. Find the word control, you can just control a company. It's an individual in control of a company, isn't it? Because that can determine whether a company is subject to taxation or not. But it is for the Honourable Gentleman to take the point. Frankly, you might be wrong. Look, I can fully understand why a newspaper reporting on it will take the point. A newspaper reporting on it says, look, the statement says one thing, and the treaty doesn't contain the third word. That's fair enough. It's a newspaper reporting the facts. It's not what newspapers do. They report the facts for readers to make up their minds. And that's why we have an objective, fair, and free press in Gibraltar to do that. And I remember to point out for the relationship between the editor of that newspaper and the Deputy Chief Minister in a way that I hope is immune to them now the opportunity of ever implying the opposite of the relationship affords them in the context of that newspaper, because what they see brings in that newspaper, they don't like that word is on the front, but somehow there's a relationship with the Deputy Chief Minister. And when they see things in that newspaper that they like, they can go because they say there's a relationship with the Deputy Chief Minister. Look at the speaker. They do what a free and fair press does. And it's right to do it. And the Honourable Member, the representative of the public, representing the Social Democrats in this House, to say, I found a major point, because the word control is not there, simply betrays the fact that he is, in some respects, simply more impolite, as he has been on Facebook. I think that there are concessions here, and they will not identify any one of them. So, the word control, in a tax treaty, is used only in respect of whether a company is brought into the tax net of a nation, or the user is not controlled by individuals in a particular place. They have excessive control, excessive self-involvement, which is
context of the political aspect of one state taking control over the other state. Not whatsoever. But let me say one more thing. If you are right about the first point, the second point will be even more ridiculous. In other words, if this was a treaty between the United Kingdom and Spain, what logic is there to say that the United Kingdom has to protect itself from a grab for control by Spain of the British Exchequer? Spain's not making any claims in the British Exchequer. So, either his first analysis is entirely false, and then he can make a second analysis, or his first analysis is right, and his second analysis is invalid. I know it's probably the end of it, because normal disability is part of the person who's thrown toy out of ground, which I look forward to seeing the conclusion of live on television tonight.
Any other questions from members of the opposition? Right, then I'll call upon the Chief Minister to move the suspension of standing order.
I think what I need to do now is to lay on the table. So I was going to think that I have the honour to lay on the table. The international agreement on taxation and the protection of financial interests between the Kingdom of Spain and the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland regarding the vote. Order to end.
The Honourable Minister for the Environment, Energy, Climate Change and Education.
The Speaker, I have the honour to lay on the table a command paper on a draft bill to make provisions for the prohibition of dealing in ivory, save for in certain circumstances and for connected purposes.
Order to end. Thank you, Mr. Order. The Honourable the Chief Minister.
One of the benefits of Brexit coming to an end is that there's less statements and less suspensions in standing order. The bigger base move on the standing order 7-3 to suspend standing order 7-1 in order to proceed with government bill.
In favour? Are we going to carry it? Bills first and second reading. A bill for an act to make provisions for offences relating to the sale of energy drinks and to provide for the enforcement of road offences and for connected purposes. The Honourable Minister for Health, Care and Justice.
I have the honour to move that the bill for an act to make provision for offences relating to the sale of energy drinks and to provide for the enforcement of those offences and for connected purposes be read for the first time.
I now put the question, which is that a bill for an act to make provision for offences relating to the sale of energy drinks and to provide for the enforcement of those offences and for connected purposes be read for the first time. Those in favour? Those against? Carried. The Energy Drinks Prohibition Act.
Mr. Speaker, I'd like to move that the bill for the Energy Drinks Prohibition Act be read a second time. Mr. Speaker, my colleague, the Honourable Dr. John Cortes, and I, on behalf of government, presented a command paper to Parliament on the 10th of December 18 on the prohibition on the sale of energy drinks to persons under 16 years of age. This episode risks of energy drinks consumption are primarily due to the high caffeine and sugar content. A 250-milliliter can of a popular brand of energy drink contains 80 milligrams of caffeine and 27.5 grams, which is nearly 7 teaspoons of sugar, whereas a 500-milliliter can of another popular brand contains 150 milligrams of caffeine or 55 grams or 13 teaspoons of sugar. This is due to the negative consequences of caffeine consumption among children and adolescents, including effects on the neurological and cardiovascular system. High consumption of caffeine reduces insulin sensitivity and may lead to the development of type 2 diabetes. Caffeine overdose can cause significant neuropsychiatric and cardiovascular effects, such as palpitations, hypertension, diuresis, central nervous system stimulation, nausea, vomiting, mild hypercholesterolemia, metabolic acidosis, and convulsions. Despite the association with sport, high intake of energy drinks may cause obesity due to the high sugar content, dental cavities and smear layer erosion causing dental hypersensitivity can result from the acidic pH and high sugar content of energy drinks. Mr. Speaker, energy drinks can also cause physical dependence and addiction, and these physical states can follow children and adolescents into adulthood. Other behavioral outcomes include sensation seeking problems with behavior
education and cognitive capabilities in adolescence. Government funding is great partnerships for the local Sarah Blazer Child Public Health Program Champ, which has been sponsoring healthy living courses for children and families since its inception in April of 18. Champ is a speaker seeks to help make the right choices for easy choices for the local community and has advised the government on this important issue of limiting the sale of energy drinks to the proposed cohort of the divorced population as set out in the bill. There has been a consistent call from the lead scientific and public health researchers in the field for restrictions to be put in place to limit sales of energy drinks, and this House will demonstrate leadership, courage, and foresight to implement even ahead of the UK internationally validated public health recommendations. The House, once again, therefore, Mr. Speaker, will clearly affirm a commitment to continue to lead the people of Gibraltar into a healthier future and healthier lifestyle. The bill, Mr. Speaker, introduces offences relating to the sale of energy drinks and provides for the enforcement of those offences. Clause 4 defines energy drink as any liquid intended for human consumption other than tea or coffee that contains over 150 milligrams of caffeine per litre. Clause 14 provides for the amendment of self-definition in the event that the Minister for Health considers it necessary due, for example, to changes in scientific opinion on the said level. Clause 5 creates the offence of selling energy drinks to persons under the age of 16, with any person guilty of doing so facing a fine at level 3, which is £1,000 on the standard scale. Clause 5.2 provides a defence of reasonable belief in the viability and 5.3 for persons charged as a result of acts of others to demonstrate that they exercised all due diligence to avoid committing the offence. Clause 6 requires the display of a notice in premises for energy drinks to sell, specifying that it is illegal to sell energy drinks to anyone under the age of 15. Anyone, Mr. Speaker, including a body corporate not complying with this notice, shall, pursuant to Clause 7, be liable to a fine up to level 4 on the standard scale, Mr. Speaker, which is £400. Lastly, Clause 8 prohibits the sale of energy drinks from vending machines and renders the owner of the machine, its operator, the owner, or relevant premises and its occupier, including bodies corporate, liable to a fine up to level 3 on the standard scale. Would you think aware that not trying to single out any one individual in discussing the general merits and good of the bill, I feel I must publicly thank and highlight the commendations Dr. Annie Dye, who is our lead pediatrician in our DHA. I have personally witnessed Annie's unthinking dedication, commitment, and contagious zeal to improve the health and lives of the children and young people of Gibraltar. Annie has been, is, I suspect, will always be, a constant champion of children's best interests. And I'm sure that our House will wish to join me in acknowledging and thanking Annie for her care of our children's health and well-being. Mr. Speaker, this therefore with great personal pleasure and satisfaction, and on behalf of my colleagues, Dr. Jacob Jessel, I commend the bill to the House.
Before I put the question, does any honourable member wish to speak on the principal convention of the bill? Yes, the Honourable Robin Jennings.
To the Speaker, on this side of the House, which I've been proposing the bill, I did bring this issue back into the House back in September 2017 as a result of what I was feeling. And the response that I got from parents in particular, who are noticing an increase on dependency from young children, especially teenagers who are attending our schools on energy drinks. And I appreciate that the health minister has taken this on board as it was practiced back in June 2017, privately, and no doubt we are stepping in the right direction. And as the Health Minister has already said, that we are actually doing something actually sooner than what is being done in the UK, which is still in today's stage in the UK, as they do look to regulate between 16 and 18 years of the decision.
Can the Minister clarify one thing to me in relation to the definition of energy drink and in relation to liquid as well?
the Honourable Minister will obviously be aware of the term free workout drinks. In fact, the common version has had some members obviously may not be listening, but I'm sure he and I are familiar with the term free workout drinks, which include very small capsules of highly containing caffeine. Would the law in this case apply to those types of drinks that are available in many hospitals in Gibraltar? Also, would it also apply to the gels that can be available, because they would not fall within the definition of liquid? It just occurs to me now, by reading the context of this bill, that they may or may not be captured, depending on his answer.
Is there any other contribution before I ask the Minister to reply? The Honourable Dean Costa.
Mr. Speaker, in the first place, to address the Honourable Mr. Yamas, and of course to thank the Honourable Members of the Opposition for indicating support for this bill. And he said that we have, as I noted in my speech, got to the stage even before the United Kingdom, but I think I would like to point out that this government has been on the vanguard of changes in legislation ahead of the United Kingdom, not just in this respect, but also in respect of events on a large scale. Yeah, and also, of course, as well as civil partnerships. So we do try as hard as we can to stay ahead of the curve where we think the matters are important. And in response to the Honourable, the leader of this comment, if the free workout were to fit within quite the definition of the bill, then the answer is yes. Of course, so long as it takes to the sale of such a product to somebody who's less than 15 years of age. It is now appropriate for the content of the definition of the bill, yes.
And I'll put a question, which is that a bill for an act to make provision for offences relating to the sale of energy drinks, and to provide for the enforcement of those offences and for connected purposes, be read a second time. Those in favour? Those against? Carried. The Energy Drinks Prohibition Act.
Mr. Speaker, I beg to give notice of the committee stage and third reading of the bill to be taken today. With all honourable members agree.
Do all honourable members agree that the committee stays on third reading of this bill be taken today? A vote on act to amend the Presence of Crime Act 2015, the Terrorism Act 2018, and for connected purposes. The honourable minister for health care and justice.
Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to move that a bill for an act to amend the Proceeds of Crime Act 2015, the Terrorism Act 2018, and for connected purposes be read a first time.
I now put the question, which is that a bill for an act to amend the Proceeds of Crime Act 2015, the Terrorism Act 2018, and for connected purposes be read a first time. Those in favour? Those against? Carried. The Proceeds of Crime and Terrorism Amendment Act 2019.
Mr. Speaker, I beg to notice that the bill for the Proceeds of Crime and Terrorism Amendment Act 2019 be read a second time. Mr. Speaker, even though it has not been my practice to speak on bills which are presented aside on a provision by provision basis, I think that on this occasion such an approach is warranted. The House will be aware that the bill has been subject of a certification by the Honourable Chief Minister pursuant to Section 35(3) of the Constitution. Such certification meaning that the bill is too urgent to permit the usual delay required between publication and listing proceedings. The bill is also unusual in that it contains a number of miscellaneous amendments to different pieces of legislation. It is for these reasons, Mr. Speaker, that I am of the opinion that the bill would benefit from more detailed examination from me. That would be usual and simply speaking to the merits of the bill generally. Mr. Speaker, first of all, some general background as to why the bill is urgent and why it is needed. The bill makes various amendments to our legislation mainly in the areas of the persons of crime, terrorist financing, and terrorism. Mr. Speaker, most of these amendments may be split into two main categories. The first category relates to amendments that correct mainly to geographical errors that have been spotted in these pieces of legislation. The second category concerns amendments that clarify provisions of our legislation further to the preparations that have been undertaken by stakeholders, which include the Judiciary, the GSIU, the Office of Advisory Council, the Gaming Commissioner, the Office of Criminal Prosecutions and Litigation, the Office of Parliamentary Council, the Office of Fair Trading, and the Manival Coordinator and Study for both Brexit and the visit next month by Manival Evaluation Team. Manival, Mr. Speaker, is a committee of experts on the evaluation of anti-money laundering measures and the financing of terrorism and of the Council of Europe with 47 member states, reporting directly to the principal organ, the Committee of Ministers of the Council of Europe. The task of Manival is to assess and comply with the principal international standards to counter money laundering and the financing of terrorism and the effectiveness of their implementation, as well as making recommendations to national authorities in respect of necessary improvements to their systems. The Vortex has, Mr. Speaker, previously been evaluated against international standards in the field of money laundering and terrorist financing. This was set in 2006 and undertaken by the International Monetary Fund. The Vortex did very well against the standards as established since then, but standards have moved on considerably. When the IMF considered that the Vortex did not, because of its size, present a systemic risk to the international financial system, we were left without a mechanism by which we could prove our adherence to international standards. After some 12 years of trying to join Manival in order to be peer reviewed, we finally managed to be admitted on this evaluation using the fifth round evaluation methodology, which is known as the Texas Regional Style Body of the Financial Action Task Force, if they don't know one, but not one from which the voter may fly away from. It is, Mr. Speaker, of vital importance that the voter continues to be seen fully compliant with such international standards, not least, because one of the biggest selling points is our reputation we have worked hard to create and must be retained. Mr. Speaker, moving on to the provisions of the bill itself, the amendments contained in clauses 3, 2 to 9 and 11 amend sections of the Purpose of Crime Act 2015 which set out the manner in which the Gibraltar Financial Intelligence Unit, the GPU, interacts with other financial intelligence units around the world. The current legislative provisions have to date focused specifically on such interactions where the other financial intelligence unit is based in a member state of the European Union or, in a few instances, a member of the Edmund Group. The Act has been silent with respect to the manner in which interactions with other financial intelligence units are to be undertaken. Mr. Speaker, I hear Mr. Smalling's decision to note that the Edmund Group refers to a united body of 159 financial intelligence units. The Edmund Group provides a platform for the secure exchange of expertise and financial intelligence to combat money laundering and terrorist financing. The changes to the law now expressly set out the procedure to be followed by the GPU when it receives disclosures that concern states or territories outside borders. It also sets out what criteria it would follow when A, requesting federal information of entities outside the border, or B, to receive a request from a known in the financial intelligence unit for the dissemination of the information or document by that financial intelligence unit to a competent authority, agency, or department within the state or authority of the financial intelligence unit. In such cases, the dissemination would be subject to set restrictions and conditions for the use of that information or document as it is by you deemed appropriate and reasonable. This ensures that it is clear on the face of our legislation as well as in practice that the GFIU may not only share intelligence with other financial intelligence units around the world to assist in combating money laundering and terrorism, but also that if the intelligence being acquired by a known financial intelligence unit in that other jurisdiction, there is a procedure set out as to how such requests should be handled. Mr. Speaker, the amendment in clause 210 to section 1(2) of the Purposes of Crime Act is one where there is, as it says in the text to be inserted, merely for the avoidance of doubt, so inserted. There has never been any doubt in the minds of the government, law enforcement, or stakeholders that the words independent legal professional include, but are not limited to, a barrister, solicitor, or other lawyer, and the legislation has always been construed and worked on that basis. an intent and this is the quote, it is best to spell this out on the face of the act, as there appears to be a contrary view which we do not accept, that this wording does not include lawyers, but rather other professionals in the legal sphere. It is for that reason alone, Mr. Speaker, that the amendment is included. The amendment in Clause 312 corrects erroneous cross-references in the Act. The amendments in Clause 313 are aimed at clarifying situations in which relevant persons, subject to the provisions of conduct, by procedures, enter into business relationships with customers. In particular, the amendments make it clear that a relationship where the relevant person is asked to form a company for its customer is to be treated as a business relationship for the purposes of the Act, whether or not the formation of the company is the only transaction carried out for that customer. Clause 313 also addresses when, as we see, associations are to be treated as entering into business relationships with persons. The amendment to Section 11 of the Business Requirement, containing Clause 314, again, arises from the spectate of that Act undertaken by stakeholders in the run-up to the manual evaluation. Section 13 of the Act deals with the application of due diligence measures and, in particular, when relevant businesses need to apply them. The amendment is designed to clarify the section. This again is a clarification of our legislation for the purposes of the manual evaluation rather than a change of section. Clause 315 amends Section 15 of the Process of Crimes Act so as to include financial institutions within its unit with regard to the criteria regarding correspondent banking relationships. The amendment in Clause 316 is to correct and cross-reference in the Act. Clause 317 amends the list in Section 31 of the Process of Crime Act of sections which include requirements of speech in a criminal offence. The amendment to the amended list reflects money laundering requirements. The amendment in Clause 318 adds a specific regulation that compares the Process of Crime Act so as to allow the Minister with responsibility for finance to make, amend, or replace regulations made under this Act regarding a register of arguments and official owners within Gibraltar. This power will allow for the Minister to make the register public in accordance with relevant international standards or obligations and make further provision regarding how such public access is granted. Further powers to make subordinate legislation are included by means of the amendments included in Clause 319, which inserts these sections 184A to 184B into the Proceeds of Crime Act. These powers will allow for subordinate legislation to be made so as to allow our authority to deal with requests and court orders that are received from outside supporters where such requests and orders are made in furtherance of investigations and proceedings regarding the Proceeds of Crime. Furthermore, Mr. Speaker, there is also the power to make subordinate legislation allowing for assistance in external investigations into the Proceeds of Crime and money laundering. This is something that, to a certain extent, is possible under other legislation, but not catered for specifically under the Proceeds of Crime Act. Mr. Speaker, our authorities already have the power under Section 179 of the Proceeds of Crime Act to make such requests for assistance in civil proceeds of crime investigations to overseas jurisdictions. They also have similar powers under other mutual legal assistance legislation to make requests relating to criminal investigations. These amendments, therefore, expand on the general power to make subordinate legislation and follow similar provisions in the United Kingdom's Process of Crime Act of 2002. It is arguable that such a power is already a part of the general regulating legal power contained in Section 184 of the Act. However, I am also advised that rather than rely on such a general power, it would be preferable to have specific provisions included on the face of the Act in order to avoid all doubt. Mr. Speaker, I am also advised that such provisions are expected by Moneyval and the government's intention is, should this provision become law, to make subordinate legislation closely modelled on the United Kingdom's similar legislation in time for the Moneyval evaluation. Clause 320 sets out the jurisdiction of the Office of Fair Trading under the Proceeds of Crime Act by setting out on the face of the Act that they are the supervisory body for real estate agents and dealers in high value goods. The amendment also corrects the manner in which the office is referred to in the schedule. The final amendment in Clause 3 and Regulation 11 of the Supervisory Bodies Powers Regulation 2017. This is another amendment which is included simply for the avoidance of all doubt and reflects in legislation the fact that a supervisory body may issue a permanently acceptable code of guidance in respect of the laws concerning the prevention of the launching of offences of crime or terrorist financing as it considers relevant. Mr. Speaker, Clause 4 contains amendments to the Terrorism Act. The amendments in Clauses 4.2, 8 and 10 articulate topographical errors including incorrect cross-references. The amendments in Clauses 3 and 4b reflect changes in the structure to the DFIU, allowing the head of the unit to authorize specialist staff who may not be police officers or customs officers to undertake specific duties under the Act in relation to the disclosure of information and the making of arrangements with prior consent. Clause 4.4a amends the period, the notice period, in Section 53 of the Terrorism Act from 7 days to 14 days. This particular notice period is the amount of time that needs to elapse after a person makes a disclosure to an authorized officer of a suspicion or belief that the money or other property relating to a particular transaction or arrangement of service property and is being treated as having the authorized officer a consent to him unless consent is refused by them. This amendment is made at the request of the DFIU and reflects similar provisions in Sections 4A of the Purposes of Crime Act, thus providing clarity by having the same time limit for similar actions in both acts. The amendment in Clauses 4, 5, and 6 are for future prison purposes. Whereas the words United Kingdom and Gibraltar are to member state, so ensure the provision will still work in a post-Brexit landscape. Then, Clause 4, 6, as the usual form of work, the citation of a European instrument to ensure the most up-to-date version of that instrument is referred to. The amendment in Clause 4, 7 simply reworks the Section 96(1) as the current wording is not entirely clear. The final amendment to the Terrorism Act 18 is to Schedule 2 to the Act, where a new definition of gambling services is included and tied to the definition of the same in the Proceeds of Crime Act. The final two amendments to the Crimes Act 2011 and are again the result of stakeholders comparing our legislation to the money law requirements. Mr. Speaker, the usual position in our criminal law under Section 22 of the Crimes Act is that it is an offence in most cases to attempt criminal behaviour and that this carries the same penalty as committing the behaviour itself. However, there are exceptions to this. The current position is that it is not an offence to attempt to comply to commit an offence under Section 35 to 39 of the Terrorism Act. It is also not currently an offence to attempt to aid, abet, cancel, or cure or suborn the commission of an offence. The amendments to the Crimes Act exclude certain offences under Terrorism Act from the list of Section 22 of offences attempting of which are not actionable. I am informed the money right expects such behaviour to be a criminal offence. It is on this basis that these amendments are proposed. Mr. Speaker, I would like to thank the Honourable Mr. Beaton, with whom I have certainly requested to speak, for indicating that the opposition will be supporting this bill.
I confirm that I have received notification from the Minister regarding the urgency of this bill. Before I put the question, is any other member wish to speak on joint principles and merits of this bill? I will therefore put the question, which is, does any minister wish to contribute to this bill? I therefore put the question, which is that a bill for an act to amend the Proceeds of Crime Act 2015, the Terrorism Act 2018, and for connected purposes, be read a second time. Those in favour? Those against? Carried. The Proceeds of Crime and Terrorism Amendment Act 2019.
Mr. Speaker, that's the notice that the committee says in further reading of the bill to be taken today, if all honourable members agree.
Well, honourable members agree that the committee says in third reading of the bill to be taken today. Committee says in third reading, the honourable between Tennyson.
Mr. Speaker, the honourable move that the House should resolve itself into committee to consider the following bills called by clause, namely the Energy Drinks Prohibition Bill and the Prisons of Crime and Terrorism Amendment for 2019.
The Bill for an Act to make provision for offences relating to the sale of energy drinks and to provide for the enforcement of those offences at Crystal Connected Services. Clauses 1 to 8. That's part of the bill.
Mr. Chairman, can I ask perhaps the local agents a technical thing on
1 is this act may be cited as the Energy Drinks Prohibition Act, and the other is exactly this year, because the bill could not have 2019 written on it.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I agree with the point.
So, clause 1 is amended. Time part of the bill. Clause 2 to 8. Time part of the bill. The long title. Time part of the bill. A bill for an act to amend the Prohibition of Crime Act 2015, the Terrorism Act 2018, and for committee purposes. Clauses 1 to 5, stand part of the bill. The long title, stand part of the bill.
The Energy Prohibition Bill and the Crisis of Crime and Terrorism Amendment for 2019 have been considered in committee and agreed to without amendment, and I am able to review the first time back.
And I put a question, which is, has the Energy Drink Prohibition Bill and the Crisis of Crime, the Energy Drink Prohibition Bill 2019, and the Process of Crime and Terrorism Amendment Bill 2019 been read a third time and carried? Those in favour? Those against? Carried. We go back to the bill, first and second reading.
Mr. Speaker, I move that the House is now adjourned until Thursday, the 21st of March at 3 p.m. I think all of us should know that I expect to potentially have to deal with other legislation on that day. I think we all understand that the events of tonight could determine what we also would deal with on Thursday next week. Indeed, the events before Wednesday of next week could at least give us an element of clarity based on the motion that was put last night, which has been voted on in the Commons today, subject to whatever amendments may prevail or not prevail, whether or not the person in whose name the motion is standing decides finally to vote in favour of it or not, depending on how it's been amended. All of that in broglio, before we hope we'll have cleared a little by the time we meet again next Thursday.
So the House will now adjourn for next Thursday, the 21st of March at 3 in the afternoon.